This is Fresh Air. Martina's spot is work and art often intersect. While working as a tenants' rights lawyer in Chelsea, Massachusetts, he also published several volumes of political poetry. His last collection of poems, titled Rebellion is the Circle of a Lover's Hands, won the 1991 Penn Revson Foundation Poetry Award. The judges called it political poetry at its best. Espada is currently teaching English at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. His new book of poems is called City of Coughing and Dead Radiators. Martina Espada recently spoke with Terry Gross. He began with his poem, Tires Stacked in the Hallways of Civilization.
Yes, Your Honor, there are rodents, said the landlord to the judge. But I let the tenant have a cat. Besides, he stacks his tires in the hallway. The tenant confessed in stuttering English. Yes, Your Honor, I am from El Salvador, and I put my tires in the hallway. The judge puffed up his robes like a black bird shaking off rain. Tires out of the hallway. You don't live in a jungle anymore. This is a civilized country. So the defendant was ordered to remove his tires from the hallways of civilization and allowed to keep the cat.
Is this poem based on a case that you handled?
It's actually based on two cases, which I consolidated for the purpose of writing the poem. But in fact, those exchanges did take place.
What were the cases about?
Well, as the poem implies, the cases had to do with both a rent arrearage and an eviction action brought by a landlord, and defenses which had to do with the conditions in the apartment. And in the case of this exchange, the landlord, who was one of the more notorious landlords in Chelsea, actually did respond that I let the tenant have a cat, which was obviously his rationalization for the abominable situation he allowed the tenant to live in.
You obviously didn't like the judge very much, and in this poem, the judge is very condescending about El Salvador. Did you run into that a lot in the legal system?
Oh, absolutely. I have to say that most of the time it's more subtle than this. But the results tend to be consistent with that kind of prejudice. And there are times in the system when, in fact, the judges are very open about their biases. And this was one such occasion.
What's the relationship of your work as political activist to your work as poet?
Well, it's a very close relationship. My work as a lawyer dovetails with my work as a poet, as it has over many years, in that in both cases I am an advocate. I'm speaking on behalf of those who don't have an opportunity to be heard. Not that they couldn't speak very articulately for themselves if they had the chance. To think otherwise would be patronizing. The poor do make their own best advocates, which is precisely why they're often prevented from doing so. But most of them don't have the opportunities I have to speak, to write. And so I take on that role as advocate, whether it's a poet or a lawyer. And I see also a common purpose in terms of documentation. Certainly a lawyer does that, and poets do it too. So a poem like the one I just presented is very much a poem of documentation as well as advocacy.
A lot of people like to blame the poor for being filthy, so filthy that they attract rodents. Other people always blame the landlord for renting a deteriorated, uncared-for housing. Do you think the truth is always on one side or the other?
Well, I would never say that the truth is always on one side or the other, but I would say that the truth is more on one side than the other. And obviously, I believe that the truth lies more often with those who would blame the economic system, who would point the finger at those who hold property, because they are ultimately responsible for the conditions. And as far as those conditions being blamed on certain groups traditionally, I have had that come back to me in very strange ways. For example, I once represented an Anglo client who had just received a notice that she was going to be evicted. A truck was coming to take her things away the following day. And just as we were about to leave from my office to go to court, she turned to me and she said, you know what the real problem is in that building? It's the Puerto Ricans. They brought the roaches. And so I had to sit her down and give her a little civics lecture before we went off to court. And so I found myself in that position on more than one occasion.
Now, does that really surprise you when somebody who's being victimized themselves can't perceive the victimization of their own neighbor?
I wish I could say I was surprised, and yet I've seen that so many times that I am not surprised anymore. We are encouraged to blame one another rather than to blame those who are really responsible for our social, political condition. The old business of divide and rule is at work. And so it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me when the poor do not show sufficient solidarity with one another. We have been conditioned to do the opposite.
Oh, I want you to read the first part of the title poem of your new book, City of Coughing and Dead Radiators.
I cannot evict them from my insomniac nights, tenants in the city of coughing and dead radiators. They bang the radiators like cold, hollow marimbas. They cry out to unseen creatures skittering across their feet in darkness. They fold hands over plates to protect food from ceilings black with roaches.
Why did the radiators become the central image in that poem?
Well, that's a good question. I remember where the phrase came from. I remember being in my office one day and seeing the clients in the waiting area. It was crowded that day. It was winter. And from my office, I could actually hear this cacophony of coughing. I could sense that everyone in that room was sick. And I knew that they were sick because no one in that room had any heat. It was almost a given that they had no heat. And I began to multiply the numbers I saw in that waiting room, envisioning the entire city of Chelsea coughing. And from that image, in turn, sprang the image of dead radiators. And note that the phrase is not cold radiators. These are not radiators which will produce heat in a few minutes or a few hours. They're dead radiators. They're not going to produce heat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Espada. He has a new collection of poems called City of Coughing and Dead Radiators. And several of those poems relate to his years as a lawyer representing low-income tenants. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Poet and former tenants' rights lawyer Martin Espada is my guest. Since we're talking about housing, what kind of apartment did you grow up in?
Well, I was born in the East New York section of Brooklyn, and I was raised in a public housing, mixed-income public housing, in that section of New York City. And my memories of it are spotty, but I do remember the contemptuous references to the housing authority, which was, of course, our landlord, the equivalent to our landlord, and the equally contemptuous references to the maintenance men who never came and did what it was they were supposed to do, and so on. But what I particularly remember about those days growing up in Brooklyn was the paranoia, the fear that everyone felt, which, of course, sometimes was justified and sometimes was excessive. But, for example, the poem in this book, Day of the Dead on Wortman Avenue, is really about that urban paranoia.
Did you grow up afraid?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Grew up afraid, and there's such a close connection between fear and anger. Grew up angry as well. Sometimes couldn't distinguish between the two.
What was the first time you went to Puerto Rico from Brooklyn?
I was 11 or 12 years old. And I went with my parents to the island, believing what I was going to encounter was paradise. That was what we had always heard, simply because for the people in my family, that was paradise compared to here. So upon arrival, I was shocked to see concrete everywhere, to see that essentially the island had been paved, that there were signs in English everywhere, that the island had been conquered economically as well as politically. And I began to realize that, in fact, the people in my family on the island prized all things American, even where this meant they compromised their own identity. There's a poem I have in this book called Coca-Cola and Coco Frio, which is really about all of this, where I found myself being surrounded by relatives who insisted on feeding me Coca-Cola over and over again, as if they were giving me a very special treat, and that's the way they presented it to me. And then when I thought this experience was going to lapse into utter self-parody, I was taken to a roadside stand off a beach and treated to something called Coco Frio, which, as the poem explains, is a coconut which is open with a machete, and you can actually drink the milk of the coconut with a straw directly from the shell. To me, this was a revelation, absolute revelation. And the irony was that here I was surrounded by people who were celebrating this false idol, this Coca-Cola, right, which you could see all over the island, and ignoring their own miracles, which included the coconut, Coco Frio. As I say in the poem at the end, so many coconuts in the trees sagged, heavy with milk, swollen and unsuckled.
How did it affect your identity to go to Puerto Rico?
Oh, it was absolutely transformative. You suddenly realize that you have a history. A person who is not aware of having a history is like a person with amnesia. And going there affirms that you do have this history and creates a much more solid sense of identity, which in turn enables you to have the self-confidence necessary for self-defense, again, in a society which is sometimes hostile to that identity.
Was the meaning of being Puerto Rican really different in Puerto Rico than it was in Brooklyn?
For me or for people in general?
For you.
Certainly, you feel... Well, for me, even now, when I go there, it is a process of self-discovery. It's a process of learning, of constantly observing and soaking up everything. And that is very different from being here, where more often the identity is taken for granted, or where more often I find myself doing the explaining rather than the learning.
You have left your work as a tenants' rights activist, at least for now. You're now at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, teaching creative writing and teaching multicultural literary studies. How do you feel about leaving your work as a lawyer?
It's difficult on one level. I will miss certain kinds of struggles, certain kinds of moments. And yet, it has to be borne in mind that I did this work for 15 years, first as a paralegal and then as a lawyer. And there's a certain amount of burnout, frankly, that's involved with that. Also, I see what I'm doing as my response to a certain degree of disillusionment with the legal system, although I'm still a firm believer in using the law as an instrument for social change, particularly at the class action level. I have to say that years of these struggles has produced some disillusionment with the way the legal system really works in the world. And yet, it also needs to be said that I see what I'm doing now as being part of the same struggle, part of that same continuum of struggle.
How so?
Because essentially now what I'm doing is communicating ideas about this social political system as I have gathered these ideas from experience to a new generation of people who hopefully will help to change things.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Martina Espada speaking with Terry Gross. Espada's new volume of poetry is called City of Coughing and Dead Radiators. It's published by Norton. And this is Fresh Air.